I'm Evan Klein at Evangeline Cafe, and this is Good Food on KCRW. Well, I'm heading off to prison today, and so are you. I'll take you inside a lockup in Oregon where inmates are cooking under the guidance of a trained chef. It's October, and it's time for celebrating German style. I'll tell you about the tradition of Oktoberfest. I've got a restaurant to try, plus a MySpace site for food nuts. First, let's check out the local farmers markets to see what's in season this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. You know, fall is a wonderful time to plant a winter garden. Here in California, you can grow stuff all year round. And if you've never had the joy of growing your own salad and going outside and just plucking a salad right out of your garden, you should try it. And you can do it in a very small amount of space. We're talking with Cheryl Gaines right now. She's the woman at the Downtown Wednesday Market that sells the beautiful potted herbs. And Cheryl, you've got just a gorgeous garden right here. How can we bring some of this home?
Well, this time of year, it's a good time to plant a lot of the cool weather things. Like you mentioned, the salads, the heirloom lettuce mixes, arugula. A lot of those things really like our cooler weather, along with cilantro. Those are some of the come and cut and come again things that you can grow this time of year.
And mescaline, it's a mix-up. It can be 20 different ingredients.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Now, what about, you were saying before, some perennials. You can plant those now and just have them all year round. What are those?
Right. Actually, fall is an excellent time to plant your perennial gardens, especially here in California, because it gives the plants a chance for the roots to get started, and then come spring, you'll have one heck of a wonderful, wonderful garden. So your sage can go in now, your rosemary, a lot of lavenders, and they'll bloom profusely for you in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
Thyme's another one.
Okay.
A lot of them can really go in now.
And you have not just one kind of thyme, sage. You've got a bunch of different kinds.
Yes, we do. And we actually have a lot of lavenders that are blooming right now. And also the sages. Sages, there's got to be 160 variety of sages. Some of them are edible. Some of them are landscape, like the ones we have today. Mm-hmm. We've got eyelash sage. I have lion's tail. It's blooming right now. Gorgeous orange flowers.
Okay, now if I was going to plant a garden and I've got a patio, I mean, can these grow in pots?
Yes, they can.
Okay.
Yes, they can. Just needs really good drainage. And one thing I do even this time of year is put some mulch on top of the soil inside the pot. It cuts down on the amount of watering you need to do and also keeps your roots cool in the summertime and warmer in the winter when we get a little cool weather.
Okay, now to harvest these things for our garden, number one, we try to pick off any buds that start to form. We don't want them to flower. Is this true?
Well, the perennials really can flower, but it tends to make the energy go to the end of the leaves, so I do try to keep that cut back. I leave a few because I like the color.
They're beautiful.
Yes, you trim those back, and the more you pinch the tops, the bushier your plant's going to be.
Okay.
So you always want to harvest from the top.
Okay, what about all your geraniums? I've got a couple. I've got one that took over my whole backyard.
Oh, they're beautiful. They are. So there are some that get very large. The rose-scented geranium, citroses, a lemon lime, kind of a mosquito-minded plant.
And the thing I love about the geraniums is all the scent is in their leaves, and
yes,
they smell that way all the time, and you can rub against them or take some into the house or just rub them between your hands and have that wonderful smell. And the lemon one or the rose one that I have is amazing. All right, Cheryl. Well, thanks as always. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
That was Cheryl Gaines. Her stand is called It Began in the Garden, and it looks like a garden has just moved onto the street here. There's beautiful stuff, and Cheryl, as you can tell, is very knowledgeable. If you have any questions or any wild thoughts about what you want to do, come talk to Cheryl. She's going to help you make them happen. We're visiting now with Laura Ramirez. She comes in from Redlands. Her farm is called JJ's Lone Daughter Ranch because she's after her wonderful dad who recently sadly passed away. But Laura's here on her own, and she is best known for her avocados, her booming laugh you can hear all around the market. And also today she has these very interesting, we call them blonde pomegranate. Can you describe, first of all, what these look like, Laura, and then describe the texture, because they are different.
Oh, they're very different. People are kind of scared away from them when they see them at my stand because they're kind of a yellowish, kind of ugly-looking pomegranate, and everybody thinks they should be really red like the Wonderfuls, but when you crack them open, they're really sweet, so sweet. They're not acidic like the regular Wonderful is, and they're pink inside, and the seeds inside are not hard like they are with the Wonderfuls, and they're just the best. I think they're great on salads, and they don't stain clothes.
That is good to know. Yeah, because the red ones have that hard little pith in the middle, and you'll eat the seeds, and they're great, but then you got to deal with all that pithy mess. These, they just crunch right up and they're gone. And yeah. they're sweet.
I think they're the best pomegranate out there.
And tell us now, you've got these little tiny, they're called Mexicola avocados, and five for $1, and they're about the size of a plum. So what is the story with these?
Oh, those are really good too. When they get really soft, especially the skin on the outside, you can eat the skin. The thing I like about them is make sure they're really soft, and that's the way you eat the skin. And they're really anisey, licorice-y tasting, and they're really one of the old-fashioned favorites here at the market. And they're called Mexicolas.
Jet black. And then you can polish them up, and they look like like jewels. They're beautiful.
People think they look like plums. They'll come to me, are they a mix of plum? And no, they really aren't. They're really good. And even if they're a little bit green on the outside, it'll just take a few days to ripen them up. They ripen up quite quickly.
Is the pit also small, or does it have like
The pit is also small, but it's not as small as you might think. So you need to, that's why they're five for $1. You need to make up for a little bit of that.
Right, a lot of pits.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, well, this is fascinating. Now, you come to the Wednesday Santa Monica. Your persimmon season's right around the corner, and when you're coming with persimmons, you'll be at the Saturday downtown Santa Monica and Hollywood as well.
Right, correct.
That was Laura Ramirez. She calls her farm JJ's Lone Daughter Ranch. She has these pink pomegranates and then these very interesting small, shiny black Mexicola, the only avocado I believe you can eat the skin. We have a good news from Organic Pastures Dairy. That is the organic raw milk dairy up in Fresno that was temporarily curtailed from selling raw milk. They have done extensive testing. The FDA has been out there for the past 2 weeks. There was never any of the pathogen for E. coli found at any time in Organic Pastures milk. And we expect the truck here with Organic Pastures raw milk products to be back at the Santa Monica Farmers Markets by the weekend. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Have you ever heard of Oktoberfest, the nonstop beer party in Bavaria? Hans Rockenwagner, the LA-based chef, is here with me next to tell us how to get a cab home during the festival when you can't even remember where you live. When I was 17, I was backpacking through Europe for the first time. Unlike most kids who left the U.S. for European shores in the summer, I left at the beginning of fall, which is why I found myself babysitting a U.S. Army tent at a campground outside of Munich during the month of October. Can you say drunken revelry? Or maybe another word for it is Oktoberfest. So thinking back, I thought I'd ask Hans Rockenwagner for some memories of Oktoberfest and how he celebrates it now. So I really had like the sort of quintessential Oktoberfest experience. Do you have some good memories of what that would be?
You know, I have a lot of good stories on Oktoberfest. There's actually an outside area, sort of a green grass, where they sort of deposit all the guys that are completely drunk and passed out. And generally, the locals, what they do is they tape a $20 bill on the inside of their jacket. And later on in the day, the cab drivers come by. And so on the inside, they find the fare for the cab and the address where to be dropped off.
That's unbelievable.
That's civilized, right?
That is so civilized. That's so human. I love that. Now, what are the origins of Oktoberfest?
Well, King Ludwig got married to Princess Teresa. That's why the area where it's held, it's Theresienwiesen. In 1810, they got married, and they thought, why not have a party for our closest friends? And they had a two-week party in this area, and they've done Oktoberfest ever since, except for when there were diseases or wars, as we have had a couple in Europe.
So when I think of Oktoberfest, I think of two main aspects. I think of the brews, the drinking, and I think of the food that accompanies that.
Yeah, almost 7 million people visit Oktoberfest during the 2 weeks. Over 1.5 million gallons of beer are consumed. And incidentally, Oktoberfest starts in September, not in October. It ends the first Sunday in October, first or second Sunday in October, that's when it ends. And that also decides whether or not it's a 16 or an 18-day festival.
Oh, my gosh.
There are 14 tents, basically, that can house anywhere from 3 to 10,000 people.
You basically have to wait for somebody to stand up, and you have to rush and sit down in their seat.
Exactly, exactly. It's on a first-come, first-serve. So these tents have major entertainment. They have star-quality entertainment throughout the evening.
You know, as a 17-year-old kid experiencing this, I remember the women who were able to carry those huge beer.
One liter, over one quart of beer.
And they would carry, like, 20 of them,
yeah.
10 in each hand, it seemed like. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, and to be honest, the guys that consume them are even more incredible. I mean, the hardcore guys sit there for hours. They consume 5-6 liters of beer within an hour and a half and never get up once to go to the bathroom. I don't know how they do that.
So let's talk about what they're eating and drinking. What kind of beers are on offer at Oktoberfest?
The tents are actually organized by the breweries. Every year they make an Oktoberfest beer.
Now, is that beer, does it tend to be a little darker, a little more amber than what we would think of as a more summer Pilsner style?
Yes, it sort of reflects the season a little bit.
And then when we're talking about the food, the things to absorb all of this beer, are we mostly talking about different kinds of wursts?
There's one tent that strictly does fish, for instance, and they call it steckelfish. And literally what it means is fish on a stick. They stick, literally a stick, through the whole fish and angle it over a fire. And then as the grease sort of comes down from the fish, it doesn't go into the fire. It runs straight down the stick. Because very often when you grill some fish, you know, especially with salmon or a fatty fish, you have all these fires coming up and you end up with charcoaled fish. So this steckelfish is actually almost like a whole campfire trout or a whole campfire mackerel.
So Hans, if you were going to put together an Oktoberfest party at your house, what are some of the things that you would like to serve?
I would definitely do something with a sausage platter. You know, I mean, that's what people know. There's definitely a lot of pork consumed. We once had a weisswurst is literally a very white sausage, and it's veal. And weisswurst was usually the last thing that the butcher made in the morning and what the butcher would eat himself. A weisswurst was always consumed before 10 o'clock in the morning. And it's in a very thin casing. And you actually, what you end up doing, and this is a very traditional way, you would end up sucking the meat out of the casing. We at the Rock and Wagner restaurant a couple of years ago had contests of weisswurst eating, sucking contests.
Must have been a lot of fun, a lot of laughing.
It was always a big surprise who won. But actually, so the weisswurst by the locals would be sucked out of the casing. You know, you can actually just slice it open and scrape out the meat, and then you eat it with sweet Bavarian mustard and a pretzel, and I tell you, there's nothing better than that.
Sounds so delicious. So what are you up to these days?
You know, we opened this little bakery in Mar Vista that's doing very well. We do mostly wholesale, but we have a little store. We will have Oktoberfest pretzels. Those are large pretzels, the size bigger than a head, that can serve 2 to 3 people. We've also started doing something. We're making fresh Berliner. I don't know if you've ever had it. It's probably what I think the donut was came from originally. This is a yeast dough. If you do it right, this Berliner gets a ring on the outside because it rises again as it's being fried. And then you put it in cinnamon sugar, powdered sugar, and stuff it with a little raspberry jam, and it's the best donut you've ever had.
Give us the address.
It's 12835 Washington Boulevard, just east of Beethoven.
And it's Rock and Wagner Bakery.
Rock and Wagner Bakery.
It's been so great having you here this morning. Thank you, Hans.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Hans Rockenwagner. We've been talking about Oktoberfest. It's time to get something to eat. I love to check in with Jonathan Gold, LA's most prolific omnivore, to find out where to go this week. He's with me next when Good Food continues on KCRW and KCRW.com. Today, Jonathan Gold, our wonderful eater that takes us to strange and out-of-the-way neighborhoods all over Los Angeles, is going to take sort of a more moderate detour. Where are you taking us today?
We're going to BLD, right on Beverly Boulevard in the middle of the restaurant strip.
Yeah, this is a great place. This is Neil Frazier's new place.
Right, the Chef of Grace. It's a really friendly restaurant. It can function as a wine bar. They have a really nice wine list and good wine by the glass list, and a pretty big charcuterie selection. So you get all the favorite Spanish meats from La Española. You get a pretty good selection of the Framani meats from Paul Bertoli in the Bay Area, which are also good. There's a big selection of cheeses, very strong on California cheeses. You know, you can have your own sort of like poo-poo platter and drink wine.
Yeah, it's really wonderful. And they have great accompaniments, yeah, too. I mean, they have the almonds, the different pastes and jams that go with the cheeses and the meats. It's nice.
Yeah, and a really good fig bread.
But that's just the beginning, because this is BLD.
It is BLD.
Breakfast, lunch, dinner.
It's a proper dinner house in a way. They have braised pork shank, which I always think of something that shows up at staff meals in restaurants, because it's something really cheap that takes a long time to cook and not much thought, and it comes out and is really, really good. And they do a really nice sandwich with that. They do something I've never seen quite in this way somewhere else, which is they call a self-constructive dinner, which is to say you choose a protein, you know, either, you know, salmon or a piece of skirt steak or chicken, then you pick the sides that you want to go with it, you know, rapini or white beans or whatever. You pick a sauce or two if you want to add a sauce. There it is, a dinner. It's like the number two dinner at El Coyote down the street, except made with the things that we all tend to eat every day anyway.
When I first went, I really didn't know what to expect, and I looked at the menu, and I was surprised at how eclectic it was, and I thought, wow, anybody could find something they love on this menu.
Yeah, they even have what I've been calling the Woody Harrelson entree.
Which is?
Hemp-crusted tofu, which is sautés, and the hemp gives it a little bit of crunch and doesn't hurt the flavor too much. And you know, it's served on greens with a nice dressing, little bit of sesame oil. It's really pleasant. I've got to say, the last three times I've got it, I've also got a side of the morcilla, the blood sausage, in order to have like some yang to the yin.
The last three times you've had it? That's very shocking to me.
It's true, actually. I go into restaurants, as you know, anonymously, and use credit cards under other names and do the whole restaurant reviewer bit. But there was one point where Richard Drapkin, the owner, who has owned restaurants in Los Angeles forever, comes over and says, I know you're supposed to be anonymous, but you realize that you have been in here 5 days in a row.
So did you make it in for breakfast?
I made it in for breakfast. They have really good French toast. They have fantastic egg dishes, including what they call a version of Butterfield's Eggs Benedict.
Describe what that is.
It's sort of an Eggs Benedict with a red wine sauce in there someplace. And one thing that they resurrected that I haven't seen forever is broiled grapefruit.
That's true.
And they put a little sugar on it, and they call it grapefruit brulee. So it concentrates and sweetens the juice of what was a really good farmer's market grapefruit to begin with. And it's just delicious. I'm always so happy to have somebody segment my grapefruits in the morning anyway. But to like take the extra couple steps and do something that you would probably never do at home is, you know, it's a mitzvah.
It's a mitzvah. So are they open continually all day, breakfast through dinner?
They are. They open at 8 in the morning, and I think they stop serving at 11 at night.
7 days a week?
7 days a week.
So once again, tell us the name of the restaurant and where we can find it.
The name of the restaurant is BLD, and it is at 7450 Beverly Boulevard in Los Angeles.
Well, Jonathan, thanks a lot for taking us somewhere else besides the San Gabriel Valley this weekend.
Glad I could be of help.
That was Jonathan Gold. We've been listening to one of his latest restaurant suggestions. Jonathan, of course, is the wonderful writer of countless LA Weekly counterintelligence columns and the author of Counterintelligence, Where to Eat in the Real Los Angeles, published by LA Weekly Books. If you've ever worked in food service, it may have felt a bit like being in prison. But if you end up in prison working food service, it seems like a picnic. So when we heard of the medium security prison in Eastern Oregon that's hired a trained chef to cook with its inmates, we knew we had to check it out. We sent a producer to the clink. More on that next when Good Food returns.
It doesn't look like a prison. It looks more like a school or a hospital. One long, gray, rectangular box. Eastern Oregon Correctional Institution has only been in existence since 1985. Before that, it housed mental patients. The day I visited, there was a mist around the building, so it was hard to see the barbed wire. It feels a lot more like a prison when you walk in. I check in with the receptionist, put my valuables in a locker, and walk through the metal detector. Again. And again. And again.
Watch.
Dennis Courtright, the man I was there to interview, watched me through all of this while I shucked more and more metal objects, change, watch, belt, hairpins.
I have nothing in my pocket.
And through all of it, there's this heart-stopping slamming noise. No one's flinching but me.
Alrighty. Oops. Well, that was fun.
We took the elevator up to the inmates' level.
Yeah. Sure, I've already talked.
The elevator door opens. We walk through a few more computer-operated doors.
Control, this is Courtright. Can you pop SD 138?
And then we're there, in this huge kitchen, full of men looking a lot like operating room doctors. White hairnets, white aprons, chopping, stirring. One guy's pulling a huge pizza out of a convection oven. No one is shackled. It's not so unusual to have inmates working in a prison cafeteria. What is unusual is that the program at EOCI is more like cooking school. A man with a big knife is chopping an onion less than 2 feet away. It's a chef's knife with a hole in the handle. There's a steel cord connecting the handle to a hook on the table. Dennis reads me a sign on the wall behind him.
No knives beyond this point. That's our pan room. No knives are beyond that point. All the knives that are checked out are taken over to the table in a sleeve, and then we have lanyards. We hook the knives up to the table.
Every day, a select group of inmates cook breakfast, lunch, and dinner for the rest of the prison population, 1,600 men in all. The kitchen looks like any other one made for bulk cooking, with a few key exceptions. There are about 6 guards stationed in the kitchen at all times, and almost everything is locked up. The walk-in, the utility closet, and most obviously, the knife cabinet. It's impossible to miss. In the center of the main kitchen, behind a bright yellow grate, there's a yellow tape on the floor that says, "Keep 3 feet away." One of the guards explains.
This holds anything sharp and pointed. We keep it behind 2 locks. It's secured at all times. The knives are checked out to the inmates using their name and SID number.
Okay. You check out knives like books from the library. There's a kind of preschool feel to it, because once the knife is gone, there's a red marker outline of its exact shape on the door. But despite all the security, working in the kitchen is a highly coveted position. Eric, an inmate whose nickname is Kitchen God, worked his way up from cleaning floors to head cook in 3 years.
The only 2 things I have, really, is my college stuff and then my job. I'm not getting out, you know. I mean, I have a chance 20 years from now. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, this is my life, you know. And so it gives me something besides the average thought process out there to focus on.
Tell me what that is. What's the average thought process?
Self-degradation, self-destruction. It makes you feel human again, you know, because there's so little uniqueness here.
This is something I heard over and over again from inmates, how working in the kitchen gave them a break from the monotony of prison life. It seemed to open up a new mental space, an opportunity to get a little creative.
Last week we made a fusion recipe, which is that's what Courtright called it. It was barbecue sauce and teriyaki sauce mixed together, and we soaked, I think it was 450 pounds of roast beef all night in that sauce, and next day it turned out screaming. The guys loved it. I mean, it was great, yeah.
So you're here for life?
Yeah, with a 25-year minimum, so I see the parole board in 2026.
Okay. And do you think about getting out?
A little bit, not much. That's up to God, you know.
2 things keep Eric going, Christ and good food. I asked him his favorite recipe on the inside.
The carrot cake, the deep dish carrot cake, I'm just weak when it comes to, I have like 5-6 pieces. You know?
When inmates rave about the food, it makes Dennis a happy man. He's a certified executive chef from the American Culinary Federation with 20 years of cooking experience behind him. 8 years ago, he took the job at EOCI. The biggest adjustment was figuring out how to teach felons. Over 40% of the prison population are sex offenders. Most of the others are in for drug-related crimes. He was uncomfortable with the obvious question, knowing the records of the guys he works with.
Some of them I do, some of them I'd rather not know.
Who makes that call? Like, how do you decide, this guy I want to know, this guy I don't know?
It's kind of a personal feeling. Hmm. It's nice to know what they're in there for because they're standing behind you. Then sometimes you really don't want to because you might make a judgment call on it. Security is something that was all new to me. I've never worked in a place where all the walk-ins are always locked up. I've never worked in a place where you unlock a walk-in and you're not the first one to step into it. We all want to go home at night.
Outside of security, here's what keeps a prison running smoothly. Mail, visits, and food. An inmate named Ben explains.
Everything I own can fit in a drawer that is smaller than, well, it's a 2x2 foot drawer by about 8 inches high, and I have a shelf. So everything I own in life fits into that. So there's very few things that you can actually claim as mine. So when the mail comes in, it's very personal. Because a lot of people don't have the contact with people on the streets, people that love them and stuff. Visits, most of my family doesn't live close. You know, we're way out in Pendleton. You know, a lot of these guys are from the Valley or even from other states to where they don't get visits very often.
Yeah.
So it's a real personal issue. Yeah. And then food, I mean, nobody likes their food messed with.
One of the more military aspects of prison life is count. Roll call for inmates.
I need your bunk number.
It happens at the beginning of each cooking shift. They all line up and face front. There's something jarring about it. Inmates talking to you freely one moment, and in the next, barking out an ID number. Afterwards, Dennis uses this time to teach.
Like you to impress our guests with the right answers.
It's clear the guys like his little quizzes. It gives them an opportunity to show off what they know. No one is more interested in showing off what he knows than Michael. He's an older guy with a handlebar mustache. He comes up to me holding a container of pureed carrots. I ask him what it's for. He says it's for liquid diets. These are the two main candidates, guys in medical with their jaws wired shut from fighting in the yard, or inmates who've lost their teeth from doing drugs, usually crystal meth. He says this in a matter-of-fact kind of way. Then he adds,
This is my goal right here where I'm going to is because this is special diets.
Yeah.
So when I get out, I can go to any hotel or anything that has anybody that needs a dietitian, and I can fit right into that slot. So rather than rob banks, I can be a dietitian.
I like how you put that.
I didn't have the heart to tell him hotels aren't desperate for dietitians. His enthusiasm for special diets was almost as impressive as his other favorite subject.
Oh, yeah?
His implant.
Tracking device. So my planet can locate me at any time. That's all.
Are you a Scientologist?
Scientologist? No.
That's the thing we believe in L.A. It's about aliens. I don't know. I don't follow.
Well, I believe in...
This is the thing. You're hanging out, watching guys sauteing a whole bunch of chicken, and you're thinking, this is just like any other kitchen. And then somebody starts making jokes about their tracking device, and you couldn't feel more like an outsider.
Find them easily, abduct them again.
Generally, prison is a revolving door. But at EOCI, 70% don't come back. Compared to the national average, that's incredibly low. Outside of their food program, EOCI is internationally known for their successful clothing line called Prison Blues. They seem to have figured out a formula that works. Treat inmates with respect, let them earn your trust, and give them skills that will help them in the outside world. For the men who are about to get out, there's a good amount of anxiety about leaving. In the kitchen, Dennis is the go-to man for advice.
People do come to me, they ask me what they can do when they get out.
And what do you tell them?
I tell them, well, the best thing to do is shop around, see what jobs are open, and talk to the chef. Be straightforward with the chef like you are to me right now, basically, as a coordinator. And you can tell the chef you've cooked in a prison. You don't know the fancy stuff, but you're willing to learn. And a lot of times they will take you on for that.
Ben, the inmate I spoke with earlier, is 87 days away from parole. 4 years into a 9-year sentence, he started working in the kitchen. Now he's part of a small team of inmates who cook in the staff kitchen. This means more interaction with the outside world.
It's actually brought my people skills and elevated them versus just dealing with the continuance of negativity. So
yeah, you mean like people skills like, hi, how are you?
Right, right.
Literally like that.
A lot of your manners that I was taught as a kid tend to slip when you deal with other people on my side of the fence. You tend to put on a different face dealing with our environment, like our yards and stuff like that. You have a whole different persona than you do when you're dealing with staff and people from the streets. I've done a lot of things in my past, which I'm trying to atone for by being here and moving on. And this is all part of moving on, is learning about myself, learning things I would like to do, and giving myself a chance when I get to the streets. I mean, I already have enough stuff stacked against me, being an ex-felon and everything else, that anything I can give to myself, and with, as far as attitude, work ethics, and stuff like that, would be an advantage to me upon release.
He's looking forward to seeing his daughter. She was one when he came to prison. Now she's 8. They talk every week on the phone.
And it was pretty cool. My daughter told me, she said, Dad, guess what? I said, what? She goes, I'm spending this Christmas with you. And I was just like, oh.
Did that just kill
you? Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was like the first time I ever heard her call me Dad on the phone. I was just like, you know, because we got phone cubicles here, and I just kind of like stuck my head in the phone. I was like, oh, man, you know what I mean? So,
What are you gonna eat this Christmas? You gonna make the food?
Oh, yeah. My family's already told me, you know, I'm cooking. You know? And my daughter told me, she said, Dad, I bet you can cook better, Mom, huh? I said, yeah, I can.
You already planning a menu?
Oh, yeah. I told them for Christmas morning I would cook them crepes, you know, something. I could do a fruit crepe for them and stuff, so...
I ask if he can picture himself, 87 days from now, handling a knife without a cord on it.
Yeah, that's going to be nice. That's one of the first things that I would like to get is a good knife set out there.
On the day I left, Dennis got a note from an inmate in his mailbox. This is what it said. Mr. Cartwright, sir, for all your help, for the advice, and for the smile you gave to help cheer things up. For your stories and wisdom, I thank you. It was a pleasure working with you. God bless. Miguel. For Good Food, this is Thea Challoner.
That was Good Food producer Thea Challoner. We've got some pictures of Thea's trip on our website at kcrw.com. Click on the Talk menu to find Good Food's webpage. I don't know if the inmates Thea met have MySpace pages, but there's no doubt that social networking on the internet is definitely taken off. If MySpace doesn't quite do it for you, there's now a social networking site for foodies. I'll tell you about it next. That's in 1 minute, right here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. If food defines you, there's a new online gathering place for you to find the similarly obsessed. Babette Papai created Bakespace.com, a new online community kind of like MySpace, but for cooks. So that was a pretty great idea, I have to say, Babette.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Give us the sort of Cliff Notes version about what you hope Bakespace becomes. Who are your users?
Every day I'm surprised. I mean, we have teenagers, we have grandparents, we have families putting entire cookbooks, all of their family treasured memories on our site. Anyone who really is passionate about food, passionate about cooking, passionate about baking, I really believe that they will be attracted to this website.
You have a forum, I would expect.
Yes, we have a forum. It's called The Pantry. And we always tell people, come and raid our pantry. The pantry, you know, we look at it like in every great kitchen. People always come for the food, but they stay for the conversation. So we're hoping that our pantry, and we've seen that by who's been coming to our pantry, that people are starting to talk. They're talking about their favorite chefs. They're talking about, you know, lessons that they've learned. There's such a, you know, not only do you have all the recipes from the site, but you have the knowledge of all of the chefs as well. That's why we think our website has some real potential. I mean, the people, you know, we've had that's been a big surprise, newlyweds. Newlyweds have just taken over the site.
Really?
Within a 3-day span, we had 700 newlyweds sign up on the website. Every single photo was a wedding photo. It was really charming. We had a woman named Jamie submitted on a forum, on a wedding forum. About Bakespace. And all of a sudden, the women went crazy. They went absolutely nuts because they're insecure. They're trying to figure out.
That's really sad. I mean, no, what makes me sad is that people don't grow up anymore with this sense of being natural and knowing what to do in a kitchen.
I absolutely agree. And this forum, Bakespace.com, has created an environment where people can, even if they're not the best chefs, I mean, we have a woman, her name Holly, who created something called the Twinkie Masu, which is probably one of my favorite recipes.
That's hysterical. A Twinkie tiramisu? That's actually quite brilliant, I think.
Well, she said that she was in a rush. She just, I mean, like all parents, you don't have time to go out and, you know, sip, you know, slave in the kitchen all day. But she had come up with a solution, and it was spectacular. I actually found her on another site, and I wooed her. I said, please come over to Bakespace. Our members will absolutely adore your recipe. And they have.
What are some of the culinary questions that are coming up on the forums?
Because the site is all about knowledge and it's all about sharing with people, we had one 15-year-old who said that she wanted to learn how to make her own jam. She wanted to do canning and preserving. She found her way onto Bakespace.com. And we had a woman who has 30 years of experience in that. And she said, here's what you do. Here are all the lessons you learn. Here's what not to do. And then it's very easy. So having that experience of being able to bring the young and the old together and have a common thread of food has just really enriched Bakespace.com.
I think that sounds like one of the best parts of it.
Well, you know what's nice about a social networking site is it really allows us to, you know, in most recipe sites, the recipe is the end of the journey. In our site, the recipe is the beginning of the journey. When you sign on to your virtual kitchen and you see, you know, somebody posted something from Japan or there's, you know, a great new salad dressing that they came up with, you get to not only read about the recipe, you get to see where the recipe came from, you get to see the actual person behind the recipe, and you can start building a friendship and building a relationship so that when you find something that's a gem and you say, that is the most amazing recipe I've ever seen, we have a woman named Allie who has the most spectacular food photos you will ever see in your life. I can just look at them all day and just, I've gained like 10 pounds just by watching them. But you see her recipes and then you say, okay, she has an amazing taste. Let me look at the other stuff that she has. You just go down the list and all of a sudden you're sharing this entire kitchen experience with a global community.
Well, it'll be really interesting to go on the site and see how it evolves. Thank you so much, Babette.
My pleasure. Thank you for having us. We really appreciate it.
That is Babette Pepai. She's the woman behind Bakespace.com, a new online gathering place for the food obsessed. My next guest learned what real Southern food is from his grandfather, a former Louisiana house slave. I'll be back with the true taste of hot water cornbread, pecan pie, and fruit cobbler. That's when good food returns. Southern food is some of the most honest food we have in this country. It reveals hope, heartache, and what our simple comforts were. Nathan Hall's a cook who came to his love of food through family. In his work, he really looks to allow us to taste the true flavors of original plantation dishes, which also, of course, tells us the story of the lives that created them. He's been working on the first of his trilogy, a book called Simple to Sublime, a collage of Southern cooking. So Nathan, tell me when you first got seduced by the kitchen.
It was through my grandfather, Paul Bird, which was a slave. He was a house slave. He says, if you feed the land, take care of the land, it'll take care of you. So the food was done the same way. It was fascinating.
I also understand he gave you a great understanding of how food sort of embodies love and caring.
Yes. Oh, most definitely. If anyone come to your home for the first time, you should always have something sweet to give them. And that is to show them, extending like an olive branch to them, of peace, love, happiness. But at the same time, it says, sit down, have a bite. Let's break bread and talk.
So lovely. Now, during the time of slavery, and particularly on a plantation, which is where I gather your grandfather probably was, how did the slaves acquire the foodstuffs that they used to cook with? Like, for example, making desserts. Where did they get the sugar?
Well, the slaves had to be very creative. They was very innovative in what they did. The cookhouse set off from the main house. So they would go into the pantry and everything they needed that they didn't have access to at their home down in the shacks, they would just simply borrow a little bit here and there. And like the plantation butter roll, which is a story that I love to tell because that's the grandfather of all the cobblers. Then we have the fruit cobblers, the peach cobblers, the apple, the berries, and what have you, because they didn't have access to those
to the fruit.
Fruits.
I mean, in fact, would they be punished if they were found in possession of?
Yes, yes. And so what they would do, what they did for their own family, they would get a little dough from here and they get the cream from the cows and the butter that they churned from the cream and what have you. And they would take it down to their little shack and they would wrap it, roll it into a cigar, like a nice big-sized cigar with sugar, the butter. And the sugar came from the cane from what they was also had just finished growing and harvesting. And cover it with cream and put it in the oven. Well, and on top of the little stove, the wooden burning stove, or into the big fireplace. And when it finished browning, it was the most delicious, delectable thing.
So you would have this flaky, sugary, buttery roll, yeah, topped with cream that became sort of caramelized from the fire.
Yes.
It thickens a little bit.
It thickens, and it makes it a sauce. It's a real thick, nice sauce.
Man, that sounds so good. When you make that for people today, do they say, don't even bother giving me the fruit?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, when I think about American desserts, it's all got that Southern foundation. It's that simple comfort of dough and sugar.
Yes. You can use it for not only pies, but you can also use it for stuffing, for like little meat pies, and you can also use it for fried pies.
Ooh, fried pies.
Yeah. So it's so versatile. And that's what I always say to people. You have to realize and remember that we have our own food, the same as the Italians, the English, and, you know, the French. And it's just simple Southern cooking.
And truly something from nothing.
And it's truly something from nothing, because you actually go from scratch. Like the cornbread. A lot of people love hot water cornbread.
Now, how is hot water cornbread different from a cornbread that we might make with buttermilk?
Big difference. When you make when you make cornbread with buttermilk, you have to put it in the oven. But hot water cornbread, no. You boil your water, and you take your cornmeal and your other ingredients, and you mix it up, and you make a mush, and then you mold it and make into pones. And you put it in the hot oil and fry it.
Mmm, yum.
So it's more so on the inside and soft, and it's crispy on the outside.
So how did the food traditions, particularly in your own family, start to change after slavery was abolished?
Well, it didn't change, really, because what we did was embarked upon what he had given us and what he left for us. And he always says, stay to the earth, stay with the earth.
Did he get to experience freedom, or did he die as a slave?
No, he experienced freedom. As a matter of fact, he didn't die until 1958.
And so did he become a chef in a restaurant? Did he continue cooking as a profession to earn a living?
No, but he did go on to the railway as a, I forget what you call him.
A porter?
It's sort of like a porter, but he cooked.
Oh.
You know, during that time, you did what they wanted you to do. And so, yeah. In other words, you filled in where you were needed, but he mostly did the cooking.
Now, I understand that you spent part of your life, your adult life, in Switzerland, in Europe.
Yes.
You obviously took all your Southern roots with you and your love of this food. So while you were learning sort of the whole European style of cooking, were you also teaching people around you about your root food?
Yes, of course. And even now when I go over and it's like, Nathan is here. Oh, really? Well, let's have some fried chicken. Let's have some fried pies. Let's see if we can have some sweet potato pies, and then he can make us this, and he can make us that, you know. Oh, and another thing that was their favorite was trotters.
We're talking about pig's feet here.
Yes, we are. several things. I eat collard greens, pinto beans. Then there's another way I like to prepare them, where I would take the juice and everything from the pig feet, and we would make what we call hawkhead cheese. And oh, that'd be a part of that. It's just work for so many different things because of the stickiness from the skin and the, you know.
All that collagen.
Collagen,
comes.
Yeah.
Mmm. Yeah. So good. Thank you so much, Nathan. You've been such a treasure.
Thank you for having me.
That was Nathan Hall. He has a really marvelous website, nathanhallcollage.com. There are museums of everything in this world, dolls, death, a ham museum in Spain, but you won't find a museum of food anywhere in L.A. Well, that's about to change. Coming soon to L.A. is the first culinary museum devoted to Latino food and culture. With all the Latino cultures in L.A., I don't think there's a better place for it. I'll tell you more about it next when Good Food continues. John Sedler's an L.A. area chef from Santa Fe. His restaurants at Santa Steph, Bikini, and Abiquiu explored his beloved foods of the Southwest in a singularly sophisticated fashion. His recent life mission is to tell the story of tamales, and even more, to create L.A.'s first culinary museum, Museum Tamal. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Evan.
So tell me what the mission of Museum Tamal is going to be.
Our mission is really to explore all the foods of Latin America, the cooking techniques, the ingredients, and the rich culinary history. It's really looking at culture through culinary eyes.
What is it about tamales that you think is so emblematic of Latino culture in its full sort of expression?
Every Latin person really connects with a tamal. It has inherent rituals of birth and family rituals, holidays, and it's a celebration dish, and it's really a very, very high form of art. And almost all Latin American countries have some form of tamal, even in the Caribbean.
I would imagine that you're going to also focus on tools, since tools are so indicative of a culture.
Absolutely. And that's, we've broken down our exhibitions, culinary history, ingredients, food processes, the tools to make these dishes, and then where were these dishes invented? For example, some of these, the most historic national dishes of Mexico, were invented in the convents. And one of our exhibitions about the tools is called Metate, and it's really about the black lava basalt grinding stone that was really at the heart of every Mesoamerican kitchen. It was the primary tool to grind the toasted chilies, to crush the toasted sesame seeds and the pumpkin seeds. So we've built an entire exhibition about this major tool.
Now, how old is this tool?
It goes back 5,000-7,000 years in Mesoamerica.
Pretty incredible.
It's very, very incredible, and there are a lot of stories, and it's a very, very cherished cooking utensil. A household sometimes will have three or four or five. And when some of these metates are uncovered, it's interesting to see that they have a hole in the bottom of them. And it's not because they were worn out or used too much. It's because marauding tribes, when they would take over a neighboring pueblo or village, the first thing they would do is destroy the metate by putting a hole in it, breaking the chain to sustenance.
That's unbelievable. What a great story.
It was like burning a flag.
Yeah,
subjugation,
I can see that.
Yes. Yeah.
You just showed me before we came on the air a wonderful sort of video of a huge exhibition which shows the process of using the metate from raw ingredients to beautiful, fluffy paste.
This was an interactive multimedia exhibition about mole, the national sauce of Mexico. And this exhibition shows all the ingredients that go into a recipe of mole. It's 10 feet high in the gallery. And it shows the grinding of all the crispy ingredients like the long cinnamon sticks, all the toasted chilies, the toasted nuts, even plantains that are very, very squishy when they're ground on the metate. And that's very interesting that food has a sound. Food is so provocative. And all these ingredients, as they're being prepared on this large screen, you can hear the sounds of what they sound like, sort of like crackling bacon.
Really, really amazing. One of the things I love about this project is that we as Los Angelinos have the ability to get involved pretty early on in the museum's founding. And one of the ways we can get involved is to support some of the upcoming events that you're going to have to raise some money for the museum.
Absolutely, yes. And New York, they have the James Beard Foundation, and Northern California has Copia. And now in Southern California, we need to have a culinary cultural institution that binds our culinary community together. We're doing a dinner on the 18th of this month, and Mario Batali and Nancy Silverton have been very generous by offering their restaurant for us to do a small benefit for the museum, and everyone listening is invited. They could call our offices, and you'll be emailed an invitation. And Mario and Nancy are preparing dishes, and then the museum is going to be offering some ancient dishes also that will be featured in the museum.
Will there be any exhibits up? Will you have anything projected on the walls?
We're going to have small vignettes of some of the exhibits, about a half dozen. There'll be some short speeches, and there's going to be a very interesting speech by a woman named Elizabeth Shate, who's very passionate about all the workers in our restaurants, all the Latinos, the men and the women who do the cooking, the heavy lifting that are in our businesses every day making our restaurants work.
Sounds wonderful. Thank you so much, John.
Thank you, Evan.
That was John Sadler. We've been talking about the Museum Tamal, which is not in its infancy, but is growing its way to actually becoming. And we've been talking about tamales. If you're interested in being an amigo de la cocina and supporting the Museum Tamal, call 323-656-5667 to make a reservation for the evening at the new Pizzeria Mozza, Wednesday, October 18th. The Good Food Podcast is available each week. Sign up on iTunes to get the download automatically each week. You can also listen to the archive of this program or any other show when you go to kcrw.com. Search for Good Food there or look under the Talk menu. You can sign up for the weekly newsletter, too. Just go to kcrw.com, click on About, and you'll see email newsletters in that list. Jennifer Farrow's the executive producer of Good Food. Today's show was produced by Bob Carlson, Whitney Alderson, Candace Moyer, Priya Fenimore, Marina McLeod, and Thea Chaloner. I'm Evan Kleinman. Tune in next week for another edition of Good Food.